back in the 60s, psychedelic drugs had a bit of a bad name in many quarters. But in the next 24 hours, the TGA is expecting to make a decision that could change that, could see psychedelics being the new wonder treatment for conditions like depression. You'll hear more about why they are considering that and why it's considered it's a good idea. But we've, in the last hour, been looking at wage theft and, in fact, modern-day slavery. You may well have seen that video that emerged from the Central Market of a young woman purportedly asking for her money. We then find out that it was only around $10 an hour that had been withheld for the work that she'd done, and it ended up in a violent brawl. Jay gave us a call on hearing that and that discussion. Jay, good afternoon.
Hi, Sonia. Thanks for talking about this issue. It's a very widespread one and definitely one that I think needs more recognition to try and find solutions for.
And Jay, you have had personal experience with this. What was your situation?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Australia, born here, and have actually had a couple of experiences. The first was towards the end of high school when I started my first job at an education provider, and I did have regular hours each week. And when I asked my boss what my pay rate was, my boss said, oh, about $11 an hour. And I suspect it was an underpayment at the time. And when a new person took over where I was working, one of the first things we were told as staff was, good news, you'll all be getting a pay rise. And it did go up quite significantly. But that was
so someone kicked up a fuss, do you think?
I'm not sure, but it was definitely a number of years at a much lower rate.
Yeah.
And the other experience, it reminded me when you were talking about placements and sort of course and university placements and that sort of thing, because when I was about halfway through my uni studies, I applied for a job which I saw advertised, and I was shortlisted and invited for an interview. And after that, I was invited to a second interview. At the second interview, I was asked if I would be okay in starting in the role in a voluntary capacity. And because, as most students know, it's difficult financially, I said I really am looking for a paid position. And they said, well, we can offer you half paid, half voluntary. So half of your hours will be paid, half of your hours will be voluntary, and then you can perhaps count part of your hours towards your university placement, which will be coming up later in your studies. And I started in that role, you know, with regular hours each week, part-time, half of my hours paid, half of them counted as voluntary. And then I learnt that because there was no difference in my work, you know, between the voluntary and the non-voluntary hours, I should, you know, really be paid for all of the hours that I worked. And when I raised it, I was told very clearly that you should be grateful that you're being paid at all. We're really doing you a favour by giving you half voluntary, half paid. Mm. And I ended up, it was a very hard decision, but I ended up leaving because I just thought this isn't right. And it was very clear that, I just felt really exploited. And I I was vulnerable.
Yeah, so that was in a professional role.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is a thing, I think we probably often think this is happening in perhaps non-skilled industries only.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I've got lots of friends who have, you know, come to South Australia for studies and, you know, from overseas, and English is their second language, and they've had massive problems with, you know, underpayment, very long work hours without proper breaks and things like that. Yeah, I've, you know, experienced the issue of underpayment too, and I think it's really important to find a way to police it better.
Jay, look, thank you for your experience, and I think you're right. And we have been talking off air, the team, we're going to look at this further over the coming weeks. We're going to try and look at some of the different areas about this, both on the wage exploitation or the exploitation of workers area and try to look for some practical ways that you either can address it or maybe seek help if that's the case. But then obviously it then goes into the next step too of a more issue of modern day slavery. So there feels like there's lots of areas that we need to look at here, and over the next few weeks we will try to bring you some more information and hopefully some help if that's an experience you're having, that we can try and point you in the right direction, because sadly, from what's coming up on our phone and our text lines, this is more prolific than you might think. It's 12 minutes past two. Well, could psychedelic drugs be the answer to depression and other trauma-related conditions in our society? We're 24 hours away from a decision from the TGA on that, but we'll explore that area next.
Check out Jules Schiller.
Whoa, you buried the lead there. You've got Catherine Hepburn's signature.
I have got Catherine Hepburn's signature.
Wow.
Weekdays from four.
I've got Roger Moore.
Oh, my favourite Bond. What have you got?
I have John Lennon's autograph.
Wow. Who do you have?
Telly Savalas.
You got Kojak's autograph. Whose autograph have you got?
The best one is Alfred Hitchcock.
Wow.
Jules Schiller
on ABC Radio Adelaide. Spend a perfect afternoon with Sonia Feldoff.
Sonia.
On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, mention magic mushrooms, mention LSD, mention psychedelic drugs generally, and you'll get impressions of hippies and counterculture and illicit substances, obviously, because that's where that path led to back in the 60s. But you may or may not know that the emergence of those drugs started in very serious scientific trials about how it might be used, how they might be used as treatments for mental ill health conditions, things like depression and psychiatric conditions, those sorts of things. Well, after many years, I guess, in the wilderness, considered only an illicit area, the world is starting to turn again to psychedelic drugs and see and ask the question, could they be actually useful in other ways? And it's something that our TGA is going to be considering tomorrow, they've been considering it, they'll make a decision tomorrow. Tanya De Jong is co-founder and executive director of Mind Medicine Australia. Tanya, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Wonderful to be on the program.
Yeah, lovely to talk with you. This is something that Mind Medicine Australia has been advocating for some time, that we need to relook at psychedelic drugs. And in particular, I think it's psilocybin, the substance in magic mushrooms. Is that right?
It's actually two substances. So we've put in rescheduling applications for both psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapy. So both of those medicines have breakthrough therapy status with the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration in the US at the moment, which is only given to medicines that could be vastly superior to existing treatments. And what we've been seeing is that both MDMA and psilocybin therapy, after just 2 to 3 medicinal treatments alongside a short course of psychotherapy, are leading to 60 to 80% remissions for patients with severe mental illnesses, including depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, addictions, and now the medicines are also being trialled for dementia, anorexia and eating disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and a whole range of other conditions as well. So as you can imagine, I mean, the current existing treatments, the remission rates for antidepressants and or combination psychotherapy for patients with depression, the maximum remission rate is about 30 to 35%. And with current existing treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder, they're suggested to be as low as 5% remissions. Very, very hard to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Yet, you know, in these trials with these medicines, they're, you know, getting very high remissions. And what's really important about that is we have a massive mental health epidemic in Australia, which is increasing all the time and significantly exacerbated by COVID. And we need more people to be getting well and leading meaningful, contributing lives, because it's pretty sad when there's a lot of avoidable suffering in this country and people are not getting better for the majority with current treatments.
So you mentioned psilocybin and MDMA. MDMA is what we would know as ecstasy, is that right?
No. So unfortunately, there is a bit of confusion about that. So ecstasy is effectively a street drug. It often has no MDMA in the capsules. In fact, I mean, one of the big problems and why MDMA has got such a bad rap is that a lot of young people, you know, go to raves, dance parties and so on and get what they think is ecstasy, but it's actually capsules that are adulterated with a whole range of other things that could be speed, and combined then with alcohol and dehydration can lead to disastrous effects. But, you know, it is completely different to GMP grade, pure pharmaceutical medicinal MDMA at the right dose, which is used in the medical trials. And it's very important to say that in 150 recent and current trials, because there's a huge renaissance of research in this area globally, there's been no adverse events whatsoever with either psilocybin or MDMA-assisted therapy in medically controlled environments. I want to reiterate that point. We're not ever saying that these medicines should go home with people and they should try them in their own, you know, houses.
No, absolutely. But I guess this is one of the, you know, you're fighting that image, aren't you, of what psychedelic drugs have acquired over the last 50 years when they were forced into the outer. And when you look into the history of that, that was largely political reasons that forced it out into the outer.
Totally.
The scientists were very much working on the idea that this might be a wonder treatment.
Yes. No, I mean, in the 50s and 60s, over 40,000 patients were treated with these medicines, again, very safely in medically controlled environments. But then they got sort of taken up by the counterculture, and there was this whole tune-in dropout sort of, you know, saying that was going around. And unfortunately, Nixon used, you know, the drugs as a way to really, you know, attack marginal groups, hippies and blacks and others, and unfortunately criminalised the use of these medicines, which effectively stopped all research for the last 50 years. Now, this was an entirely political act. In fact, you can see documentation of his advisors saying, did we know we were lying about the drugs? And they say, yes, we did. And the thing is, these were considered the next big thing for psychiatry at the time. And it's just a travesty that, you know, over the last 50 years, there's been such a spike in loneliness, social isolation, depression, and a whole range of other mental illnesses. You know, we've never been more divided and more disconnected than we are now. And we urgently need to help ease the immense suffering that's in our communities, in our families, and, you know, in our lives, that if it's not us, then it's someone very close to us. Because the stats say, you know, one in two of us will have a serious mental illness in our lifetime.
Well, we'll look in a moment at what they're being found to do in these clinical trials. But you mentioned that there's a worldwide renaissance in taking a look at the possibility of using psychedelic drugs. What sort of countries are reassessing their usefulness?
Well, pretty much all countries around the world.
Really? It's that widespread,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a number of countries where these medicines are legal, you know, already, and have been, you know, always, like in the Netherlands, many parts of South America and so on. You know, lots of people travel to Peru, parts of the Amazon, Mexico, to actually experience these medicines and gain healing from them because they're illegal in Australia. So there's an enormous amount of tourism going to both the Netherlands and South America because people want to get well. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to undertake illegal acts here, but many people also do use these medicines in the underground in Australia. We're not advocating for that, of course. We're advocating that these medicines are available in medically controlled environments such as clinics under the supervision of trained therapists. And I'm pleased to let you know that we have just commenced the first ever certificate in psychedelic assisted therapies in Australia and in the Southern Hemisphere last Saturday, with a full intake of psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, GPs, addiction specialists, you know, a whole range of different practitioners who are participating in that course, because at the end of the day, it will be multidisciplinary teams who work together to get patients well using these groundbreaking treatments. Mm. But it's important also to say that these medicines have been with us since the beginning of human civilization. And you can see them in the ancient archaeology of Rome and Greece and other ancient cultures. And they were used and are still used in ancient cultures for healing and for raising of consciousness. So, you know, these are not something really new. They're just, you know, being used now in medically controlled environments, which is critical so that they become controlled medicines. And that's what the rescheduling is all about. It's about moving these medicines from Schedule 9, which is prohibited substance of no medical use and dangerous, to a medically controlled substance. And it's important to say that heroin, which obviously on the street is very dangerous, is used in morphine. So if you go and have an operation, you're going to be having heroin used on you when you go for that operation. So this is all about the context in which a medicine is used. That is particularly important.
Can you explain the psychotherapy side of it? So how does that treatment work in conjunction with the medical treatment of psychedelic drugs?
Yeah, great question. And it's really important because these treatments are called psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy because the medicine acts like a tool to open the window for very deep psychotherapy to occur that can get to the real heart of what it is that's triggering the patient's mental illness. So this is not just about taking these medicines and going, you know, on a trip or, you know, experience. It's actually about the psychotherapy that gets to the heart of the problem. And many of the therapists and researchers in this space describe this as two things. One, firstly, in the case of psilocybin, what's happening is that the psilocybin enables you to bypass what's called the default mode network of your brain. So if you're having the medicine, you're actually bypassing the way you usually default to your similar stuck rigid thought patterns. I'm not good enough, things won't work out, my life is rubbish, etc. And it allows them to break out of those rigid and stuck thought patterns. And it's like a rebooting or a resetting of your hard drive, in a sense. You know, you get this massive neurogenesis, increased neuroplasticity of neural networks. So you feel very connected and very one and very loved and warm during these treatments. And it's from that place that the therapist can then work with you and with the insights that you've got during these treatments to then move forwards with your lives. Instead of you being re-triggered and re-traumatized by having to talk about, you know, your trauma or traumatic events over and over, which often makes patients worse, because it's just at a cognitive level in that respect, whereas this is about going to the depth and the heart of the problem.
A couple of years ago, I read Michael Pollan's book. I think it's called How to Change Your Mind.
That's correct.
I must admit, even from my own point of view, who has been sort of very suspicious about drug use and this sort of thing, I remember thinking, wow, this is quite revelatory and seems worth at least investigating. So I presume that's what absolutely. The TGA has been doing at the moment. And what are you hoping for or expecting tomorrow?
Well, you know, with these bureaucratic processes, you can never be, you know, certain of anything. But what we are certain of is that the applications were of a very high calibre. They were supported by 80 researchers, doctors, therapists, not only from around Australia but around the world. There was also a significant amount of submissions, many of which will appear on the TGA site tomorrow. But some people, of course, wanted to remain anonymous because of their own private, you know, they don't want to necessarily disclose their mental illness, etc., and also people in the justice system and so on. But I think a lot of the submissions were made public, and we were sent a lot of these submissions, and literally there was not a dry eye in among any of our team in reading many of them, because when you read, in many cases, the decades of suffering that people have undergone, the multiple treatments that they've tried to get better, you just think, we owe it to everyone to make sure that these medicines become available as soon as possible. And Dr. Simon Longstaff, who's on our board and the head of the Ethics Centre, says it's unethical to withhold these medicines from Australians who are suffering, because realistically, the current treatments only work to heal a small percentage of sufferers. So if we can actually heal you know, the majority of people suffering in this country. Imagine what Australia could achieve. Mm. You know, imagine
what is the success
productivity
rate
and happiness.
Yeah. What's the success rate compared to, say, antidepressants? I mean, can we compare?
Yeah, so just two things. Firstly, in relation to psilocybin, which is being used to treat treatment-resistant depression and major depressive disorder, there's a trial going on at the moment at Imperial College. The results will be out in the next few weeks, so look out for that because we can potentially talk about that and get others to talk about that as well. There's a trial going on led by Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris comparing directly psilocybin with SSRIs, that is antidepressants. So those results out in the next 3 to 4 weeks. In the case of MDMA for PTSD, in the phase two trials, supervised by the FDA, which led to the current phase three trials, which are nearly complete, 105 patients with treatment-resistant PTSD for an average of 18 years, as you can imagine the suffering, 52% of them went into remission immediately after the three medicinal doses in combination with psychotherapy. But what is remarkable is that at the end of 12 months, 68% of those patients had gone into remission. Now, that's against between, let's say, 5 to maximum 20% remission rates from current existing treatments. So you can see the difference. We need to make these medicines available in medically controlled environments as soon as possible because there's just too many people suffering.
I'm talking here on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australian Broken Hill with Tanya De Jong, co-founder and executive director of Mind Medicine Australia, which is waiting anxiously for the TGA's decision tomorrow on whether a couple of psychedelic drugs will be approved for medical use in psychiatric treatments to deal with things like PTSD and specifically depression, but with a whole range of other illnesses also perhaps potentially down the track, I think, Tanya.
Addictions, et cetera.
Yeah. Tanya, one of the, I'm getting texts, you know, one text that says, please put it in the water supply. Baz is putting his hand up to volunteer for research in the field. He wants to help others. You know, there's all of that. But you're going to have a whole lot of people who are going to furrow their eyebrows and say, these are dangerous drugs. These are not ones that should be used in this way. What is happening here? How do you turn around, or do you think there's a chance of turning people around on their use in this particular form?
Absolutely. So what we need to do here is we need to focus on the safety and the science, not on the stigma. So one of the other really remarkable things about these medicines in 150 plus trials around the world that I mentioned before, there's not been one single adverse event. So no patient, you know, has died or even gone close to dying or anything terrible happening. So under the supervision of trained therapists at the right dose of GMP grade pure psilocybin or pure MDMA, these medicines have been proven by, you know, universities including Harvard, Yale, Oxford, Imperial College, Johns Hopkins University and others to be extremely safe, stunningly safe is how researchers describe them, non-toxic and non-addictive. So what I would say to people who are worried about the safety is please look at the data. There's lots of it on our website, mindmedicineaustralia.org. We have a wonderful learn section where people can learn more. And as you say, you read the book by Michael Pollan. It's so fascinating. Once you start reading about these medicines, it really is captivating. You start thinking, wow, how is it possible that we've got this lost 50 years? We have to help now as much as we can. And that's why we set up Mind Medicine Australia, and we're a charity. And you know, our goal is to educate, build awareness, and help ensure that Australia has the ecosystem to ensure that these medicines become available and accessible to all Australians, no matter where they're based and no matter their financial circumstances.
One of our texters says, the pharmacologicalization of human experience. Whatever we do, don't let people experience the full range of human emotions, medical paradigm rules. What I read about this seems to make it seem like you actually feel an excessive amount of human emotion by using this almost.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, my husband and I went to the Netherlands and we undertook sessions of both psilocybin and MDMA assisted therapy over there. And I have to say, this was one of the top experiences in our lives. We all carry trauma. So, you know, my grandparents and parents are Nazi Holocaust survivors, you know, so most of our family was killed in the Holocaust. My husband's father committed suicide when he was 13. And, you know, these circumstances, even if we're not directly carrying trauma, we're all carrying it, you know, collectively, especially after COVID. But one of the remarkable things about these treatments and what led us to set up the charity was that the sense of oneness and connectivity to self, to others, to the planet was so profound. And it's such a sense of feeling a sense of belonging. And for many people, that's what's missing. And once they get that window of healing and that full range of human emotion, instead of being numbed out, which a lot of, unfortunately, palliative, you know, and I say palliative, you know, a lot of the current treatments really just manage symptoms, but they don't actually cure people. These medicines are curative. And yes, you do need to experience a range of emotions to actually get better. You yeah. can't keep putting your head under the sand forever and blocking things out.
Tanya, look, we wait with interest to see what the TGA's decision is on this, and we thank you for joining us and explaining a bit more about it today.
No, it's a pleasure, and thanks for your support.
Tanya De Jong, co-founder and executive director at Mind Medicine Australia. On the text line, psilocybin saved my life and cured me of obsessive compulsive disorder, says one texter. Carolyn, who's a mental health nurse, says, bring it on. And this texter says, this parallels medicinal cannabis, Big Pharma blocking people's access to significant pain, inflammation relief. I don't think it's Big Pharma. I think it's government regulation at this point.